Once more into the breach, dear friend.
Else, fill the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
It's a little bit more exciting for us this week because there's a new operating system on the computer here, and it's literally a new operating system. We're actually using a modern version of Windows. How's that for weird?
That's a little scary. What are we using? What, Windows 7?
I think before we were using XP.
I know, but would we come up to Windows 7 or Vista?
No, we're a little. We are in the current version.
We jumped all the way to Windows X.
Yes.
Okay. I noticed
crazy.
The popularity of X coming up a lot. You know, like the new iPhone XS.
Yes.
It's the XS iPhone, only they're not supposed to call it that. They're supposed to say 10S.
I think it's excessive.
So I was down at the Apple store, and I was asking about it, and I said, I need the sports phone.
The sports phone?
Yes, the tennis phone.
The tennis phone, yes.
The tennis phone.
They need to make shoes in their iPhone XS shoes.
Yeah. Yeah, and they could do that, but they're not supposed to say XS because it sounds like that XS.
They could be a little bit
10S, which is what they had 10S. I said, well, it's a tennis phone then.
Well, they could be a little bit less precise and just kind of ish. It's kind of 10-ish, and then you could make shoes out of that too.
Mm-hmm. Actually,
not quite 10, but it's 10-ish.
Does that mean that the X-15 experimental aircraft, which they made movies about and everything, is really the 10-15?
Yeah,
okay.
That's really what it is.
Just checking on that. Anyway, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and we are here on October, what is today? October 27th, Saturday. And if it's October 27th, Saturday, you're certainly welcome to give us a call at 773-1400, area code 254. So it's 254-773-1400 if you want to talk about something that has to do with the economy or the markets. Not that the markets have done anything this week. or anything of that ilk. And we also need to tell you that the Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this radio program, it's also the name of an investment advisory firm in Salado, based in Salado, Texas, registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission, that gives investment advice and manages investments for higher net worth people, and that the two guys, Jeff and
Jake,
On this radio program are the same two guys, Jeff and
Jake,
who are the principal advisors in the Personal Wealth Coach in Salado. And we've been trying to work out the correlation between the two for, 20 years now?
Yeah, and I think there is a correlation. We're just trying to narrow down whether it's has to do with odd or even days mm-hmm. of the year.
Well, I actually found, in going through my man cave and cleaning it out, I actually found an audio tape from the Personal Wealth Coach, only I think I called it something else at the time.
No, it's been called the Personal Wealth Coach since 97.
Well, this was in 96.
I didn't even know.
It was late 1996, so I feel, we're now, 22 years on the air?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah, see, you are. I joined you at the beginning of 98.
Yeah,
so
but you were there in spirit.
20 years.
You were there in spirit.
Yes. Spiritually, I was ghosting through the room.
You know, it's the classic we.
Right.
When one of
the royal we.
The royal. Well, I don't know about the royal we, but it's classic. Anyway, and the information we give on here, even though we are part of a registered investment advisory firm, is not investment advice. It is educational, and we have obtained the information from sources we deem to be reliable. And have researched it very carefully, but we don't make any warranty as to the accuracy of the things we relate on this. And our opinions are not those of
Town Square.
I have no idea what Town Square or KTEM
don't
has
even know
as
if they
opinion.
Have
they may not have opinions, but ours are probably different from theirs then.
All right, we have a caller on 254-773-1400, which means that somebody's listened to us before and knows the phone number. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, during the show, there's an article in the Wall Street about spelling doom from municipal bonds. I have a couple of questions. It goes through the worst states and cities.
Mm-hmm.
But is the grading, the organization that grades municipal bonds, any chance that they're what's the word? Are they as flaky as the grading system for the investment grades for the housing, you know, the housing?
That's a good question.
And then secondly, and then I'll hang up, they mentioned something about pension bonds to cover municipal pensions. I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Let me start on that one if you want.
Yeah, you can begin. And then I've got some other stuff to throw in here, too.
Let me kick around to the grading.
It's technically called rating.
Rating.
But right. It's close.
I wouldn't pay a great deal of it. I mean, there's some degree of, obviously, research goes into the ratings that they give. But it's very important to remember that the municipality pays the rating agency to rate the bond.
Just like the other bonds. So it's the same.
Right.
You say, are they anything like the other ratings?
Yeah.
Yes, they are the same people.
And let me give you an example of how these ratings, if a bond is insured by a AAA rated insurer, the bond automatically becomes AAA. But here's the problem with that. The assumptions that go into the ratings and the assumptions that go into the ratings on the insurance can be very, very flawed, because the fundamental assumption is only a few failures will occur at any given moment in time. And if there's only a few failures occur at any given moment in time, then the insurance company should be able to cover it very nicely. But there have been some near misses in Puerto Rico and other places where if the government or something else, they had not worked out some emergency measure, then the rating agencies themselves would have collapsed because they would have had too many bonds failing in too short a period of time, and they simply wouldn't have had the means to cover it.
The insurers, not the rating agencies.
And, you know, Texas, for example, you have to do very careful research. But, for example, in Texas, many municipal bonds are backed basically by the full faith and credit of the state of Texas. And since Texas can't go negative on its budget.
Yeah, they've no deficits in the budget by constitution.
And they have a rainy day fund. You're probably in pretty good shape, but you need to be very cautious in municipal bonds, because the day is coming when there will be a day of reckoning for Illinois and a lot of other places.
Illinois is in a lot of bad shape.
New Jersey's in, there's a lot of states out there that the next serious recession might conceivably default. We didn't think it was possible for a state or territory of the United States to default until Puerto Rico did. And then people are getting back pennies on the dollar from some of their Puerto Rican bonds, and we just kind of sailing on through it.
Yeah, it's been a non-event almost in the financial world, even though from our perspective it's a major event. It's a precedent. It's kind of like from my perspective, you can throw in yours as well. It's kind of like Bear Stearns failing.
Or Lehman Brothers.
Even before Lehman's, because this is the first one. And Bear Stearns failed early on in the financial crisis of, you know, it was in 2007, and they were snapped up by the other investment banks because...
With the assistance of the government.
Yeah, the government said, hey, you guys need to snap these up, and here you go, here's these assets, and here's those assets over there, and so on. Puerto Rico's been pretty much the same situation, and we have bigger impact problems in the municipal markets. Illinois is in bad shape. All of the municipalities that I have looked at in Illinois are in bad shape. They don't have a state to back them up. The city of Chicago, which we were there in June, it is not in a growth environment. It is, you know, even when we were having the booming economy that we see today, Chicago is not really getting a great deal of benefit out of that. There are portions of Chicago that are doing great, but the same is true for Detroit. Detroit's doing well, but it's not compared to the rest of the nation.
And there's an important macro factor here in any investment regime that you want to go into. If it is a pooled investment, in other words, your money goes into a pool or you're with everybody else's money and somebody else is managing it, and
you
you're
get the money all wet when you put it in the pool.
True.
I've noticed that.
But here's the issue. In each financial crisis, each major financial crisis in the history of the United States, there have been some, there's certain industries that get bailed out in some form or fashion, but there's no remedial action taken to correct the issue. And you have to recognize that the next financial crisis, that generally means that whatever that sector of the economy is going to really hurt a lot of people a lot, because the assumption then, moral hazard. The assumption then is that somebody will step in and bail them out.
That's not to be confused with Merle Haggard. Different.
Right.
Not
right.
Merle Haggard, Merle right. Haggard. They're different people, different things.
There's two areas that I think are particularly susceptible to this repetitive failure. One is the insurance companies. The insurance companies are not backed by any form of federal insurance. They're not regulated at the federal level. And as a result, I'm talking particularly the life and health companies that issue interest-bearing what aren't securities but look and act and taste like securities,
right,
to the public in the form of annuities and life insurance. And what they do is they make these wonderful grand promises. Their advertising isn't regulated at the federal level. They're not insured at the federal level, but they hold one heck of a lot of money. And they got bailed out through extra-legal, not illegal, but extra-legal activities through in both administrations in the 2008-2009 financial collapse. And there's an assumption now that, okay, the government stepped in extra-legally and bailed them out last time around, therefore they will do it again next time so they can take all the risks they want to take. And the same thing, I think, is true at the municipal level. Because Puerto Rico did not turn into a bloodbath, largely because there was a lot of peculiar maneuvering that went on to keep it from being a financial bloodbath across the country, there's the assumption in the municipals now that the next crisis, somehow somebody will step in and rescue them no matter how bad they are. The higher the interest on a municipal bond, the greater the risk. Remember that.
Yeah, and we haven't even got to the beginning, what's happened this week. We've got another caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I didn't mean to sidetrack you on your conversation you had with that other subject. This concerns money, too. I was in a convenience store. This lady was in front of me. She was going to pay her items with a Susan B. Anthony dollar, which I haven't seen in circulation for a while, and the store attendant refused to take it because they didn't recognize what it was. And I'm just curious to find out if that currency still has any status, and why is it not in circulation like I used to see it before. You have a good day, sir. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for the call. And yes, that is still in circulation. It is still legal U.S. tender. The convenience store not taking it was out of ignorance. And they could actually get in a little bit of trouble because it says on it, legal tender. It is a dollar. People don't use coin dollars very often. So it's like, I have seen people get upset at other stores when people use $2 bills. So they're still in circulation. They're still worth $2. It's just not used very much. So people who are, for good reason, afraid of counterfeit, see it and go, whoa, good news on this, on the area of counterfeit, is that it's really hard to counterfeit a Susan B. Anthony coin. It can be done, but it's really hard to do it and do it profitably, because that's a lot of weight to carry around. If you want to buy a car with Susan B. Anthony dollars, it's going to be a lot of money.
I think one of the reluctance, and maybe warning that to come out, is the Canadian $1 coin looks and is about the same size as a Susan B. Anthony coin, but it's worth less. It isn't worthless, but it's worth less.
Yeah. There's a, just on the subject of circulation, then we can hit what's happened this week.
I have trouble with circulation.
There was a lawsuit at the end of the George W. Bush administration using the Disabilities Act, the Americans with Disabilities Act, to change the way our dollars are shaped, the paper dollars, because if you're blind and you reach into your wallet, you can't tell which is which unless you've folded them a specific way where a lot of other countries have different sized
right.
paper currency. Well, the government lost that lawsuit, and were told by the courts that they needed to come out with different sized currencies.
And of course, they immediately did, and today we have different sized currencies.
They're still working on it. It's been more than a decade. They're still working on it. Whether or not it's useful or not, it's just one of those things. Currency is odd. Our government is not known for doing things quickly, and when our government does try to do things quickly,
they screw it up
yeah. really, really, really royally. And a great example of that is that the family separation issues, zero tolerance policy at the border. There was not a good plan in place for that period. There wasn't a plan. The people involved didn't know about it until the order went out.
Oh, they didn't know about it until they got tweeted.
Right, until they got tweeted. And then the government tried to do what it was being told to do by its boss, and they really messed it up. It's just the normal thing. I mean, you gotta build the systems. Part of the problem, this is, you know, we're still kids separated from their families out there. This, I know this is a political area, but we're just talking about response time in government. One of the reasons why kids are still separated from their families is because the software that was already out there for ICE didn't include a checkbox or date or location for where the kids are separated from their parents. So there was no place to write it down. It's all computerized. So there was no place to click. So the people that were still trying to connect, we still haven't updated the software if we were going to do that. So it takes years to update that software.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing, you know, just said at the beginning of the hour that we've updated our operating system here at the studio, and I look at the new system, and there's a lot of new stuff, and we got to figure out how to use it, and how many people are making mistakes on this new software throughout the week. Well, imagine that multiplied by 100,000 government employees, and what that says is the government's not very good at reacting quickly to things. So
yeah,
unless it's the military, and that's a completely different area. And even the military, when it comes to certain areas, it's slow to react. So let's say what happened today, or what happened today, this week.
I got up this morning.
Week. Yeah, and, I did too. I'm working. Yeah,
had a cup of coffee, and we had a, let's say, interesting week in the market. The for the week, the S&P 500 was down 3.94%, and some time ago in the newsletter we write, we noted that you might want to note a closing of 29.29. That's a memorable number. It turned out that it was the high, pretty much actually 29.30 point something is the high mark that the S&P 500 hit. And that was back in September. So we've been bouncing off a high mark and breaking, just barely breaking records. But basically our high point in this stock market expansion was on January 26th. The record-breaking close highs that came later, and there were two of them, were just teeny tiny little bit more. And so now we're down. And we're down, the S&P 500 is down about 9.3%. Now, if you take it from the highest point it hit in intraday and the lowest point it hit intraday, it's down a little over 10%. So the Financial Times is saying we're in a correction, and the Wall Street Journal is saying, no, we didn't quite make it to correction. But if you take a look at the Dow transports, it's in a correction, very definitely down more than 10%.
The Nasdaq's in a correction territory.
But probably more importantly to the average person who's looking at their statements or whatever, it is down year to date. All of the indices are down from the beginning of the year, and they aren't up much from a year ago. And as time goes on, unless we get some great improvement in the market, you're going to see a one-year loss number pop up. Very notably, the stimulus created and the euphoria created when the president announced that he was going to usher through a big tax cut at the end of last year, the market jumped upward. And it kind of seesawed around upward at that point. And
that's still where we are.
We're now below, actually,
right,
where we were after that euphoria. the we might as well call it a correction because
that's what it is.
Now, why? Well,
there's a lot of reasons for that.
Number one, it's October.
Yeah, it's
this
October.
This is the month when we do corrections.
Number two, as earnings have been coming out this since September for the quarter, the number of warnings that we're getting from the S&P 500 companies, so there's about 500 of them.
There are, yeah.
And
it's an interesting coincidence.
A majority of them have issued warnings about the trade war, that's going to impact their bottom line, and it may be significant. Caterpillar said that it's already cost them $40 million.
Just in this last quarter.
But they are projecting, if we don't have a change to that throughout next year, they're talking in the billions of losses associated with the trade war. 3M, who you would think, 3M, they do paper, right?
Which at one time was Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing.
Right.
They
do Post-it notes. Well, why should Post-it notes be, and because they're talking about the same $40 million or so loss, and the reason was because of paper. We have tariffs on paper, and there was a federal court ruling that declared the tariff on pulp paper from Canada to be illegal, so there's not a tariff on it anymore.
But the price still remains up.
That ruling, by the way, said there was no strategic reason why pulp paper was needed in the United States, so it wasn't, and that was a unanimous ruling from a large council.
But it's been appealed.
It's been appealed, and when it comes to aluminum or steel, it's a lot easier to say this is a strategic thing. And the president only has the authority to put a tariff in place if it's a strategic threat to the United States. So expect a lot of lawsuits on this back and forth because, to say it lightly, people are not agreeing with each other across the aisle right now. Democrats are not agreeing with Republicans and vice versa, and that's getting involved in the economy.
There's a fundamental reason that we're getting a correction at this point, and it really boils down to the fact that we've had, for example, the average increase in earnings annualized or from last year in the S&P 500 so far in this reporting season, which is for the third quarter, has been 22%. You've 22% increase in profits, which just sounds astonishingly good. Why would the market start to take a nosedive if we have a 22% increase in profits?
Well, there's a good reason for that.
And the answer is, first off, about roughly 12 of that 22 points is strictly due to the tax cut, which means that a year from now when we see the profits again, if everything remained exactly the same, those gains would only be 10% instead of 22%. And when we look at used to getting 20-some, 24, 22% rises year over year in earnings, and then the following year you only get a 10% rise, well, that's going to hurt the stock market some. The other thing is the stimulus is starting to run out of steam. Now, we did a seven-year tax cut with a $1.5 trillion, or actually one, it's going to be closer to two now, $2 trillion addition to the deficit, with additional government spending and with borrowing a lot of money and taking in less revenue, and it all is working out that way. The problem is that's a one-shot deal that we're going to pay for I don't know how long, and the issue is that the stimulus is running out of steam at this point. Why is it running out of steam? Yes, people have more money in their pockets than they did a year ago, but again, as we go into 2019, they won't have any more money in their pockets in mid-2019 than they did in 2018, because unless we get a second tax cut. If we get a second tax cut, then we'll really get into trouble, because then we'll have bigger deficits and we'll reach unsustainable debt in the United States sooner, and that'll scare the market. So we're kind of stuck in this position where the economy is overstimulated due to borrowed money, and we're running out of capacity to make more stuff. And this is, let me add something. I know I'm kind of going on here.
I'm all in agreement.
But let me say something really critical here. In September, which is the last month, logically, that we have data for, the trade deficit broke all previous records.
Yeah, this is the balance of trade and import-export, which we don't think is a good number, but these are the numbers that are being used to justify the trade war.
And why do we have record exports and a fall off, record imports and a fall off in exports? Well, the fall off in exports is largely due to tariffs and counter-tariffs and so on. The sudden rise in imports is really simple. The consumer in the United States, due to the tax cut, has more money to spend than we can possibly manufacture stuff in the United States. And as a result, they're buying more stuff from overseas, and the tariffs have effectively raised the dollar against the Chinese yuan about 7%, which offsets any counter tariffs. It gets sort of really weird at this point, but the bottom line to it is Chinese stuff is now cheaper than it was, and we have more money to spend than there's stuff made in the United States. So, so the tariffs,
the stuff,
and the tax cuts are increasing the trade deficit.
The stuff in the United States has gotten more expensive to U.S. citizens and much more expensive to people outside of the United States. So that's a... that's just the result of tariffs. That's you know, you can look back in history at any time tariffs have happened, they increase the price inside the nation with the tariffs. Great example.
In
one
many
that
cases,
doesn't you don't have to dig back very far. Look back at Japan during the 80s. They had massive tariffs in place on everybody, and their cost of living went through the roof, while their imports also went through the roof. So all the things that they were trying to do back then to make their internal businesses more competitive, you don't get more competitive by giving everybody else handicaps. You get more competitive by giving yourself a handicap and then overcoming it.
And
just ask any coach.
There's a crucial element about tariffs that my guess is President Trump is unaware of. And that is, every time in history that tariffs have been imposed to try to change the economic status of the world, the country imposing the tariffs is the one that loses the most.
Yeah.
And that sounds really goofy, but it goes against the gut reaction of, if we charge more for stuff that's being imported, obviously less stuff will be imported, we'll make more stuff here. Well, for one thing, we're also putting the slam down on immigration, legal or illegal. And so we don't have enough workers, and we don't have enough highways, and we don't have enough truck drivers, and we don't have enough railroads. So we don't have the capacity to utilize all the money that's floating around, which means that we're starting to get inflation. The Fed needs to raise interest rates, which makes doing business more expensive in the United States.
There's a story that came out in the Wall Street Journal yesterday morning, October 26th. And the headline is, Foreign Aluminum Producers Shake Off U.S. Tariffs. When the German manufacturers of aluminum that sell to the United States were questioned on their profits, which many of them posted, their profits are way up. Not only do they shake off the tariff, they're making more profits. The reason is, the tariffs affect the price of aluminum that they sell to us. So there's a 10% on there. So there's a 10% tax. But the price of aluminum manufactured inside the United States has gone up closer to 40%. So the foreign sellers of aluminum to the United States just raised their prices up the 40% level, and now their profits are through the roof. Which is the effect, anytime the government gets involved in an economic cycle, they don't have the nimbleness to approach this correctly. And anytime you give a handicap to prices elsewhere, it allows the people inside the non-handicapped region to slow down and do it in a much more relaxed way. So there's a lawsuit. The U.S. steel workers are suing the steel manufacturing companies because their wages haven't gone up, while the steel companies are making these massive profits. And they say, why haven't our wages gone up? And the boards of these companies have responded, we don't know when the tariff's going to stop. We could write you a contract, a three-year contract, which is what the steel workers are wanting, to boost their wages dramatically. the tariff could go away tomorrow, and then you're all fired because we cannot pay these contracts if the tariffs go away. That's another issue with trade. And if we look at the market, what we've also seen in the postings with the earnings coming out, building at the corporate level, you know, it's easier to do now because you get an immediate tax write-off for a lot of this stuff, has dropped drastically. Massive drops in the amount of building that's taking place in the corporate level. It's, I think it's a 9% year-over-year decline.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was that's because of a flaw in the tax law, too.
There's one flaw in the tax law. When people in charge, the CEOs, are asked why it is that they're not planning to build more plants in the United States, seeing as it's all set up to do that, the first thing they say is, well, we could make this significant investment, but as soon as those tariffs disappear, that's lost money. Number two, labor costs are so high right now and getting higher that it's not profitable unless we raise prices across the board to do a big, significant investment inside the United States. So where we are is you can't expand faster than you have the capacity to expand. No matter how much extra money you get, right, that extra money then just contributes to inflation, which is why we're seeing the cost of labor go up, why we're seeing the cost of houses go up. And then the response to that from the Fed is we better raise interest rates so that loans are more expensive, so that we have less money entering the marketplace to cause more inflation. There's already enough money in circulation because of the tax cuts. So we're starting to see, and because of the tariffs, so we're starting to see the inflation really kick in. I don't see a recession happening this year. I don't see a recession happening even the early part or late part of next year. Could still happen. And I think we're in agreement on that. We're still looking at maybe late part of next year or sometime in 2020.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the greater the boom that precedes the recession, the greater the recession tends to be. But it's going to be a cyclical recession this time around.
Not the big ones.
Yeah. Barring an asteroid hitting us or something, or an earthquake, the big one hitting in California. But the recession that we see coming in probably 2020, possibly late 2019, maybe 2021. But the point is, around 2020, we see a recession coming, and we see a recession coming because, let me give you an example. A big piece of this 3.5% GDP report we just got, an unusually large piece, was inventory buildup.
Yeah.
Which means that people that sell things are buying extra stuff above normal amount of inventory buildups, which makes for more business in this quarter. But when demand starts to fall off, then they wind up not buying stuff, which starts us in a downward spiral.
Right. I want to add to that. Inventory buildup, we've been moving to a on-demand economy for a little over a decade, more than that, and maybe 15 years. We've been moving to an on-demand economy, and it was led by McLane's here in Temple. When Walmart bought them, they bought them specifically, I mean, it's a great shipping company, but they bought them specifically for the software, the barcode scanning software that allowed the instant order on purchase. You buy a tube of toothpaste at Walmart, they're already ordering the other tube of toothpaste to come and replace it. They don't need a big warehouse facility in that situation. When you influence the supply chain, which is what tariffs do, it slows everything down. We've hired a lot of ICE employees, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The majority, vast majority of those people are going to the I part of ICE, immigration. But we've just instituted some massively complex tariffs, which means we need more of the C part of ICE, the customs folks. We're having a massive backlog at all the ports because we don't have enough customs officials to go and see which tariff applies, if any, stamp it properly, charge it properly, and then send it on. And that's a problem. That means that if you're in business, you can't do on-demand ordering. You can't imagine that in what, a month? You won't have your part when it was happening to you a day? It was happening one day wait time versus a month wait time now. So this is part of the reason why inventories are building up, because they go, we need to have extra stuff available. We don't know how long it's going to take to get that stuff to us. And we've got some commercials that we need to play.
Right. We've had a backlog of inventory commercials.
Yes, inventory commercials, they're backlogged. And just as a side note, the typical cyclical recession in the 20th century started because we had inventories grow too large. So one of the benefits that we had in the last decade is that we didn't have that as a drag. So we're going to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side. If you want to join the conversation, if you disagree with us, if you agree with us, if you just have a question, the phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and we'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Let's see what else is going on in the big wide world. We mentioned that there was a 3.5% increase. The Commerce Department announced, the BEA, one of our favorite organizations,
Bureau
of Economic Analysis.
Yes.
So they're anal and they're bureaucrats, a bunch of anal bureaucrats.
Yes.
That's cool. I would love to actually see where they work. I have this image of lots of guys sitting around with green eye shades and little desk lamps. And
well, it's a very secure facility. It's not a little thing to get in there.
Yeah, I would be. If given a choice between going seeing the floor of the New York Stock Exchange and seeing the BEA, I think I'd go see the BEA because it's really cool. Anyway, but I'm a geek. The GDP, if you actually go to the news release from the BEA News, you can really, if you're an economics geek like I am and we are, you can read a lot of interesting stuff in there. 3.5%, that sounds really good until you realize it was 4.2% last quarter. That's a 17% drop. And Moody's Analytics and just about everybody else is saying it's probably going to drop again in the next quarter, and it's going to drop again in the next quarter, because this is why. Our sustainable GDP growth based on our capacity, our transportation capacity, labor capacity, manufacturing capacity, you go look at all this stuff, the fastest it can run right now is 1.8 to 2% a year, somewhere between 1.8 to 2%. If you go faster, you're burning up future capability. You're burning through stuff. In other words, you're not doing the maintenance you're supposed to do. Unless we get a lot of infrastructure investment, which we're not getting, then you just get this short shot, but the reversion of the mean rears its ugly head. In other words, if we run along, let's say we did run along at 4%, we would guarantee a 0% return recession until we returned back to that 2% level. And it's a price you pay when you run something too fast and too hard and don't do the maintenance and don't do the things you need to do to take care of it, then you run beyond capacity for a period of time, you can just bet on the fact you're going to get slapped in the face somewhere down the road. And that's the thing we're focused on right now. And to keep from saying that we're being unduly pessimistic, during recessions, we point out the same thing. We're now performing so far under capacity that when we come back, we're going to come back like gangbusters. And get ready to come back like gangbusters. Well, we're saying now that the United States economy has been given artificial stimulus. It's basically on cocaine.
Yeah, and that's a problem. And it's not a problem immediately.
We're going to pay for it down the road.
Right.
Actually, it's not more like cocaine. It's more like meth.
It's more steroids, I think, in that it's causing fractures rather than mental instability. One of the economists that I follow is Brian Westbury. And I generally agree with him, and I agree with him now. He's saying, watch out for the pessimists that are going to point out the inventory buildup as being a big problem, but don't forget to take into account that we had an inventory drop the quarter before.
Right.
And that's true. So when we're saying inventories are building up and it's one of the problems that long-term can lead to recessions, I don't see that happening right now, but as long as we have that extra friction in the economy of the trade war, we're going to have larger and larger inventory builds up because that's, you got to. If you're going to make a sale, you have to have the product on hand to sell.
Well, you used to, till Amazon came along.
Well, even Amazon, if you have a choice, you're a Prime member, right?
Right.
If it has the Prime button on it or it says free shipping might be coming in a month, which one are you going to click?
Yeah, well, it's 2 days, and that's the big deal.
Yeah, so the two-day inventory thing, this is going to put a squeeze on Amazon at some point because the customs side of this is not nimble enough. The government needs to get more folks in the customs, and we've got the money to pay for it coming from the tariffs to pay for customs. We just need to do it. We're spending a lot on immigration. Not that that's a horrible thing, but getting the customs up when you have a tariff, it's just as important as getting immigration up when you have a zero tolerance policy.
There's another number in there that's, unless you're really geeking out in the on the Bureau of Economic Analysis report, you might miss, and that is that the 0.8 is the number, and the 0.8 is that in the third quarter, business investment in durable goods.
Yeah.
That's the equipment like computers and machines and things that enable future growth to be high, grew by 0.8% on an annualized basis. Now,
that's flat.
By itself, it doesn't mean much until you realize that in the first half of the year, the average business investment in the two quarters that comprise the first half of the year grew at 10% a year.
Right.
Which means that businesses took advantage of the new tax law to buy a lot of new equipment that could potentially give us better growth in the future.
Better productivity, better growth, a lot of good things there.
And they have slacked off to no more, we're not doing this anymore, or we're not increasing our purchases anymore. And that is something we've talked about. If you've listened to us for any length of time, you know that during recessions we get excited when we say we're coming out of this because business is starting to invest
right
in items that are going to produce long-term growth. When they back off,
we get a little nervous.
By the way, in the fourth quarter, I expect to see that as a negative number. There's already indications out there that they're going to really slack off on buying. And the reason is they're hitting capacities. They're hitting... You know, we can buy new machines to make more stuff, but we can't hire anybody to run the machines.
Right.
We're kind of stuck there, and we're just wasting money by buying this stuff. And again, this is and there's a lot of this has gone on this year. A lot of borrowing from the future.
Right.
To make the present look really good, and very frankly, there's a political motive behind it, and that's to do well in the midterm elections.
Well, that's part of it. When you just go strictly to the corporate level, the new tax law came out, and there's a lot of stuff that people have been saying, we'll buy that at some point in the future when the tax bill allows us to. Tax bill comes out, they bought a bunch of stuff. They said, all right, these are the things that we've been waiting for. We need to get these things purchased. Now they're not excited about the new tax bill. It's just this is the norm. Next year they can buy it, or this year they can buy it. They don't have to buy it all today. And this is kind of like if there is a sale on your favorite toothpaste, how much extra toothpaste are you going to buy because of the sale? Are you going to buy 5 tubes of toothpaste because it's on sale? Well, some people will. But most people will probably buy 2 tubes of toothpaste.
But then
eventually, if the sale just stays on there, they go back to just buying 1 tube of toothpaste because it's not really a sale if it's there forever.
And there's this issue of, we used to call it time value of money, which is coming back into phrase. But the issue is that you got to store the toothpaste someplace.
Yeah, yeah. And that's so the inventory buildups that we've seen.
That costs you money, in a sense, and if you buy a new cabinet to store toothpaste in... And
right.
The toothpaste has a shelf life, so eventually... So there's all kinds of things that rotate into
right.
this.
The economy, I wish it was as simple math. But it has the behavior of people wrapped into it. And what we said earlier about aluminum and how that the aluminum tariffs have caused profits for German aluminum manufacturers to go really, really large, they're making lots of money off the United States because of the tariffs. That's behavior, because the aluminum manufacturers in the United States raised their prices above the tariff amount, because they figured we don't have to be as competitive anymore. We're going to raise prices. Well, the competitors from overseas said, okay, we'll raise prices too. Eventually, that's going to come home to roost. There will be competition at some point, and the danger is that the people that have been honing their skills and getting better at what they're doing and finding better approaches to manufacture aluminum are going to stay around, and the people that are getting paid more to do exactly the same thing are going to disappear. And that's the danger that we have ahead. That none of this is written in stone. None of this says that U.S. steel manufacturers are going to go away or U.S. aluminum manufacturers are going to go away, but they will if they don't continue to try to remain competitive in a really beneficial situation for them. Why should they have to? Well, because we don't know how long those tariffs are going to last. The president may not even know. He may have criteria set out. I don't think he's just, you know, letting it out there. He might have some criteria that says this is when I'll do it.
I think he'll get rid of them when he feels like it, just like he started them when he felt like it.
I agree with that. And that it makes business decisions very difficult. And if you give a bunch of wage increases to aluminum manufacturers in the United States, that will keep aluminum prices higher after tariffs go away, you're in trouble.
There's another item to worry about, and it won't affect it until the long term, and it also is 0.8%. But that is, there's actually a fall on the other side of that, and that is that long-term orders to manufacturers for long-term durable goods are barely rising at this point. And we've talked again, we've said this again, if you go back to, if you were to listen to us during the depths of the recession, we were very, very focused on the fact that when durable goods purchases came up, that indicated things are going to get better in the future. When durable goods purchases orders fall off or go flat, that is an indication that a couple of years from now we could be running into a problem. It really boils down to the fact, and Jake mentioned this, there was a built-up demand. The demand has basically been filled at this point, and it should just, things will level off for a little while, which is what we're seeing this. Now, if we follow history, historic cycles, then they'll start to fall because people have bought all the new stuff they want to buy.
Yeah, and there was a buildup in demand for washing machines. Those are durable goods. And a lot of people were buying washing machines. The American washing machine manufacturers had taken it kind of on the chin during the recession. So foreign competition started getting stronger. We saw the tariffs hit there first, and we saw washing machine sales for the United States drop, and for everywhere else too. So tariffs are dangerous, and we're about out of time for this hour. We'll be back next hour, though. Do you want to give us some information on who we are and how they can contact us off the air?
Well, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach, and it will remain the Personal Wealth Coach next hour, too. But you can give us a call locally at 254-947-1111. Or
you can go to our webpage or toll-free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. Or you can go to the webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. That's TPWC.com. We're having some issues with the radio program recordings up there, so if anybody's got recordings from the past month, we'd really like to get copies of them. You can email us directly, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. And usually we would have a 10-second thing here with the change in the operating system. We've got another, 5 seconds to talk.
Four,
it's really
three.
Until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.